This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
So me and Alyssa are going to talk about a couple of the themes that we think are most important that we cover in the book, and I'm going to talk a little bit now about JVP's, what we call growing while sharpening. In other words, growing JVP's membership and influence while also making sort of bold political decisions, moving ourselves to the left and how we did that. And that's some of what I think we're both proudest of about our time at JVP. Not just that we did it, but that we did it with processes that brought our membership into the deliberation and discussion about it. So we were able to make these sort of hard call, what felt like hard calls at the time at least, brave calls, without losing membership and in fact bringing new people in. So JVP in first, before 2015, actually starting around 2011, held a really long internal process within our membership to endorse Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS, and we endorsed it fully in 2015. And then we had a sort of similar process in which resulted in 2018 in us becoming officially anti-Zionist. And for younger folks in the room, that might not sound like that big of a deal, but as you know, still, as far as we know, we're the only significantly sized Jewish group that has endorsed either of those positions. And at the time, it was really outside the bounds of anything being talked about inside the Jewish community. And like I said, just want to say, like, it took some nerve, and I think as organizations become bigger, it can really become easy to sort of lean into fear rather than boldness and to feel a little bit committed to the status quo. Like, you think you're doing a good job already, and so you're like, why would you change up what's already working? And also, as you become bigger, you have more obligations. You have more obligations to your staff. You have more obligations to your members. You want to, there feels like a complicated thing to make real shifts in the work that you're doing. And I think probably in any decision like this, but in this one in particular, like, there's also always a worry that you are going to lose legitimacy in the community that you're trying to organize. In our case, we are organizing the Jewish community. So would we, by becoming anti-Zionist, would we lose legitimacy? Would we not be able to do our work effectively? And those fears are real. I don't want to pretend those aren't real. And we also wanted to make sure that we were weighing equally or more the fears that I think are often discounted or ignored, which is like the fear of not taking action, and that we would lose legitimacy with our partners. Like, we would alienate our partners, we would alienate our allies, we would alienate the leaders of our movements and that sort of thing. And so we tried very hard as we were doing that process to be taking all of those things into account. And I think one of the things that's important to say is that much of this process was not at all publicly evident. JVP was like seen in a very simplistic sense, I would say, in the public sphere. And we have and had many multiple constituencies within it. We had rabbis and we had students, and rabbis who had to deal with their Jewish congregations were very different than people in universities who were just starting their careers and like everything in between. So like, whether you worried about lobbying your congressperson or you were worried about your Jewish congregation at home, like, or whatever, made a very big difference in how you're approaching this question and what was possible. So yet some people were more worried about losing access to Jewish community or losing access to members. I did want to note that we were able to do this and take this decision because we had built out a fiscal model that meant that we didn't have to rely heavily on any one donor or foundation. we hadn't been able to get foundation. There's a whole other story around that about how we hadn't been able to get foundation money. So we built out a fiscal process where our donors supported us. But that was actually very important because we felt like we had the political independence to do what we wanted and would not be able to not lose our funding. And it's, you know, like, usually when you're talking about these kind of decisions, you're talking about the political ideology and stuff like that, and that was the driver. But I just want to be realistic that you also have to take those things into account. We, of course, were thinking, I think an important thing about JVP that especially was solidified once we endorsed BDS was that we weren't a Jewish organization only speaking to Jewish people. We were an organization that cared just as deeply, if not more so, about our Palestinian partners and our partnerships with other organizations that people of color-led organizations, groups in other constituencies, other folks. And so we had an accountability to them that led the kind of work that we were doing, and that made a huge, huge, huge difference. And then there were just the political conditions that we were taking into account. So like the ways that anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism were already being conflated, and that if we made the decision to be openly anti-Zionist as the largest grassroots Jewish organization, that that would help create space for Palestinians and others to talk about anti-Zionism. And that it was a specific role for a, as a Jewish organization to create that space, because it would we knew it would change the conversation and the narrative within the Jewish community and beyond. So those were some of the things that we were taking into account. And the process was very intense. I won't go into all the details, but we did lots of different talks within our chapters, in our big national membership meetings in this very hotel. We had like online zines. We had giant webinars. We did a lot of different things. It took several years. For some people, it took too long. But I think the most important thing to say is because we had that very, very deliberative process, when we finally made our decision, not only have we not hardly lost, did we not lose any members or donors, hardly at all. Like I can literally probably count on one hand the people who left the organization over the decision. The people who were uncomfortable with the decision or weren't quite there yet understood that it accurately reflected the vast majority of the membership's position and that it was the outcome of the process that made the most sense. So for organizing, I think that's really, really important in terms of keeping your folks together. And not only do we not lose members, but we actually grew our membership because people were appreciative of our clarity, of our boldness, of our willingness to be accountable to Palestinian partners. And so we were able to reach people we hadn't reached before who hadn't felt like they had a political home. And I think that making that decision also just meant so much to our Palestinian partners, like the words, just even if our actions didn't, like it's sort of interesting to think about because our actions didn't actually change much by becoming anti-Zionist. We were already running bold campaigns, we were running BDS campaigns, we were speaking out, we were supporting and defending our partners, but the fact that we were saying that we were anti-Zionist really, really mattered enormously to folks. And I think just to like end here and pass it to Alyssa, just that we amass a certain amount of like political and social capital, both internally and externally, in the time leading up to making this decision, and we just sort of realized that that was exactly what that political and social capital was for, was to spend it, and that we had an opportunity by doing that to change the conversation significantly, and so and doing it just really remains one of the things I feel most proud of, and has been so important, I will also say, in the last 10 months. Just the fact that JVP has been was already anti-Zionist when the genocide started last October meant that there wasn't a lot of, didn't need to be any deliberation within JVP about the political positioning, and so we could spend all of our time on action.
Hi, everybody. So I want to pull on, you know, the book is called Solidarity is the Political Version of Love. And that's a quote from a beloved Jewish ancestor, Melanie K. Kantrowitz, who coined that term. And one of the reasons that we kind of were drawn to that title for our book, one of the things that we explore is that solidarity for how we approached it at JVP and how we think about it isn't a kind of taking direction from Palestinians and doing whatever they say without some kind of understanding that we have a kind of stake in that, right? We have a stake in our solidarity, right? There's a self-interest there that is, you know, it's not altruism, right? Like we actually have a stake in it. And because of that, it makes our work, and I'd be curious the other panelists to reflect on how this works in your organizations, but for us, part of what that means is that building a political home inside the organization is really paramount to the success of the organization. And the reason why is because to step out on this issue means giving up a lot of communal comforts and familial relationships and friends, right? And that's true for all of us that are kind of going against the grain of our communities of origin and our family, right? And so it's a pretty big ask as an organizer, right? To get people to kind of like give up those communal comforts. And so what's really critical is that in the practice of solidarity, you are making it possible for people to step into that relationship of solidarity by building political home, which means a place where they, everyone can show up exactly as they are. Because often it means that they're being in this work means that they're not able to do that, right? Around the family table or in the community centers or the other institutions that people are a part of in their community. So creating a political home where people can let their hair down and also be challenged, right? It's not just to comfort and nurture, it's also to do political education. It's also to be in relationship where you're kind of challenged to move your politics, as Rebecca was explaining, through the kind of processes that we engaged in. So as an example, you know, for us, and we talk about this in the book about how, you know, part of being building a political home is like wading into the waters of that are kind of tricky of political identity, right? And the Jewish community, it's particularly fraught, right? There's lots of different ways to be Jewish and understand yourself as Jewish, right? Some of us are religious and spiritual, some are cultural, some kind of have been alienated from Jewish communities because of unconditional support for Israel. Some of us grew up in communities very deeply inside of Zionist communities, and we have had to leave them and forge a community throughout. And, you know, part of this is there's a little, it's interesting because in the book we tell a lot of stories that happen in this building. So it's kind of funny to be here because we had a major membership meeting here in 2017 where a lot happened. So there's a lot of different stories in there. And one of them I'll just tell as an illustrative example of kind of the power of building political home. And I just want to put a little asterisk that this story is about a religious and spiritual component, but I want to emphasize that within JVP there is, you know, a lot of people who are whose Jewishness is really more cultural and secular and have like a long heritage of being red diaper babies. And right, like, and it is about culture and language and art and food. And like that is, and I want to emphasize that that feels like a really important part of Jewish lineage, and one that like I really want to emphasize is like a core part of the kind of the rich tapestry of JVP. So the quick story to illustrate the point of just the power of political home is that here at that membership meeting in 2017, when we gather, we had, you know, of course, optional Shabbat morning services where people could pray together. And one of our chapter leaders from our Tucson chapter had earlier that year gone into remission from cancer. And in Jewish tradition, there's a special blessing that you say in front of an open Torah during a Shabbat morning service to give thanks for surviving a life-threatening incident. And she had been saving up reciting that prayer in front of the open Torah until she came to this meeting, because there wasn't a congregation in her home city where she felt comfortable and safe to offer that vulnerable blessing that was so deeply personal, right? It was just about, it was about her surviving cancer, but it had to be in a place where she could be her full self, where there wasn't going to be an Israeli flag behind the open Torah, and where she knew that people, she could be exactly who she was when she offered that prayer of thanksgiving. And that story always like sits with me as a kind of really powerful example of just how potent political homes are, right? They transcend just are the shared values and principles that we come together with to do our political work, and you know, at their ripest, like are able to allow us to have deeper meaning in our families and our personal lives and moments of sacredness. And so I offer that to kind of like have, and when you guys are thinking about kind of how what we're saying kind of like reverberates in your organizing? Kind of imagine, like, what are the parallels in the community that you work with culturally, or religiously or spiritually, where you could create these opportunities for people to have that sort of healing experience, whether it is prayer-wise or just the healing experience of being in a community where they can be exactly who they are.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for all being here. I know this is the earliest panel on Sunday morning, and I was not expecting this many folks in the room, so that's awesome. My name is Pranay. I'm the Organizing and Advocacy Director at Hindus for Human Rights. And, you know, it's a real honor to be here and to share the stage alongside my amazing co-panelists. So I should say that technically, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm here in place of Hindus for Human Rights co-founder and executive director Sunitha Vishwanath, who was going to be on this panel, but is actually right now in Palestine in the occupied West Bank as part of a delegation of faith leaders who are there to observe the situation on the ground and provide protective presence. She was going to be there alongside our UK director, Rajiv Sinha, but Rajiv was denied entry to Israel by border officials. Thankfully, Sunitha was able to make it in, which is really good news for her, but not so great for you all because you are stuck with me. But I promise I'll try to do this justice. So just as a bit of background, as Aline mentioned in my introduction, Hindus for Human Rights is an organization that was founded 5 years ago in 2019. We just celebrated our fifth birthday in July. And our purpose has always been to organize against caste Hindutva or Hindu supremacy or Hindu nationalism and all forms of bigotry and oppression within the Hindu diaspora, specifically in the United States. But we also have a growing presence as well in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the UK. And, you know, especially here in the U.S., we are one of, if not the only Hindu organizations in the country that's actively resisting and speaking out against the rise of Hindutva ideology at a time when pretty much every mainstream Hindu group in the diaspora and in India alike has, in fact, aligned itself with this essentially fascist movement, this movement that wants to turn India into a majoritarian Hindu ethno-state where Muslims, Christians, caste-oppressed minorities, and other groups are, you know, treated as second-class citizens in an apartheid system or even expelled or exterminated. So that's what we're up against. And what I'm explaining, you know, we're a new organization, so a lot of people haven't heard of us before. I mean, I'm sure for many of you in the room, this is your first time hearing about us. And when I'm explaining who exactly Hindus for Human Rights is and what HFHR does to people who've never heard of us, I often refer to us as the Hindu JVP. And, you know, I say this somewhat facetiously, and there's usually a chuckle in response to that. But I think there's also an important kernel of truth there, which is to say that we at HFHR are able to do the work that we do now, the work of organizing Hindus to say not in our name, to reject Hindutva at a time when we're being told increasingly that those two are synonymous. We're able to do that because it was anti-Zionist Jewish organizers like Rebecca and Alyssa and so many others who paved the way for us to do so. And like that really, you know, I cannot stress that enough, that it was anti-Zionist Jewish organizing and the long history of that organizing that has showed us what it actually looks like to have those hard conversations, to break down years and even decades worth of nationalist propaganda and outright lies when we're talking to our parents and our neighbors and our friends and our extended family, the people we hold in community who have been, you know, in various ways indoctrinated into this ideology of hate and supremacy. Those are really hard barriers to break down. And I think it has been our comrades in the anti-Zionist Jewish movement that have showed us what that looks like. They've been such a crucial source of light on our own path of organizing against supremacy within our Hindu community. And, you know, I could, and this is important because, as I'm sure many of you know, I think more and more people are seeing this now, particularly since October 7th, the many, many interconnections and parallels and convergences between Hindutva and Zionism and between the Indian and Israeli governments. And I could sit here and go on for hours about this, but I actually want, I'm not going to do that. I want to use, I think you know, we've all heard this enough times by now, and I'm happy to talk to folks, you know, afterwards about it. But I actually want to use the rest of my time here to talk about some of the most important differences at play when it comes to anti-supremacist organizing within the Hindu and the Jewish communities. And that's not because I don't think there are many important intersections. Of course there are. But rather because I actually think that even though we often, you know, don't talk about them as much, it's the particularities of our fights that can often prove most instructive in terms of how we then need to show up in solidarity with each other. So I think the first key difference that I want to highlight, and maybe even the most fundamental difference, is the complicating factor of caste. You know, despite the claims by Hindu nationalists who want to downplay or even deny the violent structural realities of the caste system historically and in the present day, the fact is that those realities of caste continue to touch virtually every aspect of social relations within South Asian communities, both on the subcontinent and in the diaspora, because when we immigrated, we brought caste with us. I think particularly when you consider that the vast majority of Hindu Americans in the United States come from dominant castes, which is an inversion of the demographic pyramid in India, which is sort of due to the history of, you know, immigration laws in this country, which, you know, I can get into later. But like that demographic reality adds a level of complexity to anti-supremacist organizing in our community that doesn't really exist in quite the same way in the Jewish community. Because not only do we have to organize against Hindu supremacy writ large, but we also have to simultaneously break down the far more ingrained and entrenched manifestations of Brahminical caste supremacy, including within progressive spaces. And this also opens up in those same progressive spaces, you know, a very real debate that there is to be had over what does Hinduism mean in a context of anti-caste organizing. Is there such a thing as an anti-caste Hinduism? Obviously, at Hindus for Human Rights, we have a position on that question. We think that there is such a thing. But there is a very legitimate and very vibrant debate being had in, you know, progressive and left-wing South Asian spaces right now. And that, you know, that debate shapes our organizing in unique and particular ways. Again, I'm happy to talk more about this in the Q&A. But, you know, just to keep things moving, I think another key difference here is the histories of our respective communities when it comes to activism. You know, there's a really long and venerable history of progressive Jewish American activism and organizing, from the civil rights movement to feminist struggles to the anti-war movement. But the South Asian, and specifically the Hindu American diaspora, just doesn't really have as robust of an activist legacy on which we can build. Not to say that there isn't a history, but it just, you know, it's a orders of magnitude less, you know, less established. And I think to the contrary, actually, many in our community have unfortunately internalized this very harmful model minority narrative, right? Which is trying to convince us that the key to so-called success in American society is to work hard, keep our heads down, pursue proximity to whiteness, and of course, avoid stirring the proverbial pot at all costs. So for HFHR, in our work as a diaspora organization, this means that not only are we trying to combat and organize against the rise of hate and supremacist politics within our community, but in many cases, we're also showing folks in our community what activism and organizing even really look like in the first place. And there's often a much higher barrier to entry there that we need to contend with. And I think the last sort of significant difference that I'd highlight here is, before I wrap up, is the fact that compared to the issue of Hindutva, the issues of Zionism and the Palestinian liberation struggle generally have much higher name recognition for a lot of people. And what I mean by that is that, you know, not only is there an established, decades-long global movement of solidarity with the Palestinian struggle, even outside of Jewish communities, but even for people who aren't on our side of that question, there's at least like a basic level of familiarity with the terms and the concepts being talked about that just isn't there in the same way for Hindutva. A lot of people are only hearing about these things for the first time in the last few years. And that means that even when we're talking to folks within our communities, but especially when we're talking to non-South Asians, we often have to contend not only with the challenge of convincing people of our position on these issues, but also with the challenge of, you know, making the case for why these issues are even relevant or why people should care about them in the first place. And so again, I'm not highlighting these differences to say that there aren't parallels or intersections in anti-Zionist Jewish organizing and anti-Hindu organizing. If there weren't those intersections, I wouldn't be on this panel. Rather, I'm bringing these points up, I think, to make the argument that while we can and we should draw inspiration and guidance from the fights that are being waged in other communities, I think it would be a grave mistake to try and simply copy and paste the tactics and approaches of others without stopping to consider the unique dynamics that we have to navigate in our work. And this, I think, speaks to the fundamental and most important challenge at the heart of all solidarity work, which is the challenge of striking the right balance between universalism and particularity, of recognizing the fact that our struggles are shared and interconnected, while also recognizing the specific ways in which our identities, our histories, and our community dynamics are unique and must be approached with care. So I'll conclude now by, you know, nodding in the direction of where I think we need to go from here. one of HFHR's main areas of work, especially in the last year, has been to anchor the Severa Coalition, which is an interfaith, multiracial, and anti-caste coalition of Indian American and non-Indian American organizations that have come together to publish research and lead advocacy campaigns intended to shed light on the growing threat posed by the Hindu supremacist movement and ecosystem in the United States, and in particular, its increasingly close convergence with other sectors of the far right. This includes the Zionist far right and also, to a growing degree, the forces of white Christian nationalism and Islamophobic extremism. And so the sobering reality that we need to contend with is that our adversaries are aligning and alerting from each other and coordinating with one another more closely than probably ever before. And I'll quote here from the Severa Coalition's first report, the introduction to the report, which was published this February, and which reads, quote, "In the struggle against the authoritarian far right in the United States, the positioning of growing non-white immigrant communities, like the Indian American community, will be crucial. If we are not alert, the transnational far right will manifest in the United States as a multiracial far right, in a form that will be virulent and many times more difficult to uproot," end quote. Combating this multiracial far right will require us to form truly broad-based, diverse coalitions that are capable of standing together in solidarity and articulating radical new visions for pluralism, multiracial democracy, and the safety and flourishing of all of our communities. And that, of course, is not a small task, but I think that conversations like the one we're having here today are a very important start. So thank you for having me. Thank you all for being here. And I'm really looking forward to the rest of this morning's discussion.
Okay. Hey, y'all. My name is Beth, and it's great to be with you all. I am with Showing Up for Racial Justice, and SURGE is the largest national organization that's bringing white people into the fight for racial and economic justice. Thank you. and so, you know, we have a very similar story to JVP as well. And I was reading some chapters in your all's beautiful book, and I was like, oh, this is so similar to SURGE, you know. And so I think to understand SURGE when you're reading that book, you'll understand a lot about us as well. But, you know, we had a similar political journey in that we have really been trying to shift the understanding about whiteness and solidarity around race away from a white privilege framework and more towards a framework of shared interest or true solidarity. I'm not doing that on my own, but also thank you. and so, you know, white privilege is a fact and it is deadly. And it is not a strategic organizing approach, right? And so, there's no quicker way to get a door slammed in your face than to tell a poor white Appalachian that they're privileged, right? And so we have to be able to bring people into this conversation, not by what they have to lose or give up, but what they have to gain, which is everything, right? And so what we are doing at SURGE is bringing people into these campaigns, often material fights, right? Like working on housing or economic justice issues. And that through those campaigns that bring us in around our immediate self-interest, we then become transformed. We have relationships with people who we might have been, separate from or never had a genuine relationship with anyone who was Black or Palestinian or, Indian or any person of color, an immigrant, right? But through this campaign, like so many of us, we change, right? And our world becomes bigger and our hearts and minds change, as well as I hope we get some housing, right? I hope we get those material things too. And so SURGE has two approaches to our work. We have a national network of hundreds of thousands of white people who are, you know, mobilized into action around racial justice, but Palestinian solidarity, and also any number of campaigns, and more recently, a lot of electoral campaigns to fight the far right and to protect the squad. And so we have been able to organize hundreds and thousands of people onto phone banks, into door knocking. And we're going to do that same thing, holding all the complexities that we're all holding in November to block MAGA at the ballot box and to defeat Project 2025, which we think is critical, while also pushing for a ceasefire and an end to all of this violence that is happening to Palestinians and that has an arms embargo, all of that as well. And so we also do long-term base building work in communities like mine in the rural and small town South. And we do that because we know that there's really no way to defeat the far right unless we defeat it where they're strongest. And that's in communities like mine, right? And so many times progressives, liberals, left, you know, that spectrum of people, we set out that fight, right? We abandon these kinds of communities. And we are really suffering, you know, economically. When I'm out knocking doors, and even in my own family, people can't afford housing. It's now criminalized to sleep in tents outside in the state of Kentucky. You know, it's hard to afford food. It's hard to find work, and let alone work that's going to give you any kind of health insurance. We can't afford medicine. We have loved ones that have died from the overdose crisis and are still dying. And so when people like us aren't in my community or in communities like mine knocking doors and talking to people, listening to them, validating that suffering and trying to hear what they're afraid of, we know our opponents are. They are talking to us. They have no problem talking about race. They have a very clear agenda. And when we are afraid to do that, or we see this as like not our work, we are ceding that ground and we're just saying, take them, right? MAGA, take these folks, right? And I believe we're up for grabs, and I know we are. And so we're going to do that good work of talking to people and bringing them in. And so we talk about at Surge, similar to what I'm hearing from my colleagues, what's our shared stake in this, right? And I love the quote by Southern white anti-racist Ann Braden, who is maybe one of the most well-known white anti-racist activists and organizers of all time. And she's also a Kentuckian. And you know, she's passed now, an ancestor, but she said, you know, we can't just do this kind of like anti-racist work as a favor to black people or a favor to people of color, but we have to be in this fight. Like, our lives depend on it, because in fact they do. Okay. And I'm going to wrap up like kind of this introduction by just telling you a little bit about myself as an example of this. My intro sounded very fancy, and I have never heard that in a big room. And I was like, oh my God, I sound very fancy. I grew up on a small family tobacco farm in rural eastern Kentucky. My dad was a coal miner and then was out of work. He was disabled for many years. And my mom worked at a grocery store as a clerk, a cashier, and then as a factory worker. And I always say what they did for work, because it defined everything about my life, everything. And we had joyful times. I really loved my people and my place and my family. And we also had a lot of hardship. I grew up in domestic violence. We often struggled to have a safe place to live that was steady. You know, we struggled with addiction in our family and mental health, and we often didn't have services and protections that we needed. And I think we all deserve better than that. And that's how I got into organizing work. And that is not a unique story. That story is shared by people all over this country and all over this world. And so I think particularly in Appalachia, we are a group of white people who have so many shared struggles with people of color communities. And so I wanted a better life for my family and my people and my place. And I know that the only way we'll ever get that is by coming together across race. And you know, like I said, our opponents, speak to that suffering, right? That need for us to belong somewhere, and they're offering us things. And so we have to make a better offer than white supremacy. And so I am really committed to fighting for racial justice and a free Palestine because I'm from Appalachia, because I'm a white working class person, and not in spite of it.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.